This is Start Writing, and I'm Joe Bendosky. This week, my guest is David McCaleb. He is the author of Recall, and that's part of a three-book series deal that he signed with his publisher. I will actually let him tell you his own story of learning about craft, and it's important. He has a whole article on his blog, and it's a fantastic and interesting read. Very much resonated with my own experience. And so with that, here is David.
Well, thank you. Well, I'd actually written the book and polished it. What I thought was a complete work. I ended up actually bringing to a couple people just in my close family and said, hey, listen, this is what I've done. I've been working on this. And the feedback that I got back was, oh my gosh, you know, it's great, but hey, there's this author group that you might want to look at. And so they're very politely telling me, you might need some help on this manuscript. And so I went to this author group and found out it was led by a couple authors and teachers. They write, they edit, they also teach at the college level, creative writing. And, this group of other authors was led by these two teachers, but this group of other authors, we would get together. And you would have your book, your manuscript read, one chapter, maybe 8 or 10 pages. And you were not allowed to respond. You would actually, just sit there and listen and take it and take down notes, whatever the comments were. And, in that respect, the idea is that the reader doesn't have any benefit of the author standing over their shoulder telling them what they intended. The reader only has what's written on the page. That's the only thing that matters is the black on white. And it took me about 4 weeks to realize, I didn't know how to write. I had finished this thing. I polished it. And, I didn't know, it was a great story, but I didn't know how to properly write it well. And so I went through an entire process of learning, and it took, I devoured craft books. I went to this group weekly, and I've been a part of it. I'm still a part of it today. It's been 5-6 years now, but it took about 2 years to redo something that I wrote in probably 6 months. It took an incredible amount of effort, but that's the process. Now I feel like I've through this group. I still go to it, and I still bring my work there, and the comments, no matter whether they're big or shattering, they're small, they're all valid because a reader, if I can address them before it actually gets to the editor or before it gets to a reader who's going to have the same potential question, it's all beneficial.
And then after working with the group, you were able to take that to a publisher, right?
Correct. Right. I'd actually shot it out to a few different places before I went and then realized my error. And afterwards, I was able to, and again, it took about 2 years to redo this work. I was able to send it out to agents and ended up getting looked at by, picked up by Kensington. And so they were happy with the quality of the work.
And then how was your experience working with their editor?
Oh, I can't say enough good about it. It was fantastic. A lot of the, there's still, don't get me wrong, there's always going to be friction, and some rough spots between an author and an editor because, they come at it from two different angles. You need each other. And the editor has to give a bit and the author has to give a little bit of advice from one of my teachers, David Poyer. He said, you know, don't forget you're the author. What you say goes. It's your work. However, the editor's giving you these comments and feedback based on experience. And so, although I do accept, just in my case, about 80-85% of the edits, a fair amount of them I can't, just for art reasons, for the craft. One little change, the editor may be striving to to may have their own agenda, but they don't necessarily realize how one little change can send ripples through the rest of the manuscript. It's been a fantastic, in answer to your question, it's been a great experience. My editor's a wonderful lady by the name of Michaela Hamilton, and we get along very well.
Great. Now, before we go any further, I want to get a feel just for the premise, the genre of your book. If you could compare it to a household name or a regular author, how would you compare that there?
No, absolutely. Thank you. It's the genre, I call it a black ops thriller. It's a military thriller, but it is more along the lines of, it's more along the lines of, Robert Ludlum, Jason Bourne, his series. It's got some Tom Clancy in it as well. It's actually probably a little bit of a mingling between the two. I'm not as technical as Clancy, but, it's not as down to, I'm not so rooted in reality, sometimes as Clancy is. There's always in my books a little bit of an element of near future, weapons capabilities. I've spoken with folks that work in various research, branches of the military. And so I kind of try to incorporate some of these things that we may have online in the near future, but maybe not necessarily right today. And I think it kind of just brings a little bit of a little bit more interest to the manuscript.
Well, I think you probably have to know a lot about weapons, because as I read it, I just assumed this was the cutting edge stuff. I remember reading in your bio you were in the Air Force, if I'm correct.
Yes, sir.
So yeah, and so for me, I think you really need an in-depth understanding of the cutting edge to be able to say, oh, this is probably just a little bit beyond that. And this is what's coming.
Right. I grew up around weapons. I've always had an interest in them. And, yes, the military background, does help me in that regard. But I enjoy everything from, I still read through books on World War II and tactics and weaponry. And, I enjoy reading about what's on the boards now and what may be in the boards in the near future. Wow. I try to incorporate that.
I think that's really interesting, particularly with that background and that interest. You don't take the really heavy hand to it the way Clancy did, because there was some detail about some of the weapons, particularly when they were gearing up for the ops, some of the more cutting edge stuff, but I didn't feel like you were drowning me in it. I feel like Clancy,
Right. Actually, on my first draft, I did a lot of that. And, that ended up coming out. David Poyer, one of my teachers is, he's a naval writer. He's a military, naval writer. And he had me strip out a lot of that just because it slows the pace. You need some of it because some readers are interested in that. And that really kind of helps them engage. But if you do too much of it, it can be distancing and it can kind of create it can create a feel for the book, which is not as immersive. It reads more like a manual, like you're saying, versus a manuscript.
As a reader, I'm grateful that a lot of that came out. I mean, I've read a few of Clancy's books, but at some point I did just walk away just because I felt that the story was just bogged down with just far too many details. I mean, two or three pages on a gun, and I was just like, I feel like the book's going nowhere half the time.
Right. You need to give it in little spurts. I was talking with an author at a conference, just last summer, and he was an author, and one of his issues was just what we're talking about, just getting out. He was a doctor, and so getting out all the in-depth medical stuff. And so we were talking about just how hard that is because it's near and dear to him, just like the weaponry is near and dear to me. But we need to always keep the reader at the forefront.
Okay, before we get much deeper, why don't you give us the hook and the premise of your book, Recall?
Okay, so the hook really is this this gentleman, Red, he's a family man. He, one night while defending his family, actually, he's being mugged in a parking lot. He defends his family. He ends up killing two of the assailants, and a third one escapes barely with his life. But a few minutes later, he doesn't remember it, doesn't remember anything about it. And, so as he starts to discover how he did this, as he digs into his past, I mean, he must have been trained. And so digging into his past, as things start to come out, there's certain characters of his past that start to come out from the woodwork and threaten to overtake and threaten his family. And, so the hook really is in the first chapter, and the hook is important because you need to be able to try to hook folks. Like, the goal is get them to read the first sentence. And from the first sentence, you want to hook them enough to read the first page. And on the first page, you want to hook them enough to read the first chapter. And by the end of the first chapter, you better have them through the book. So the idea was, by the end of the first chapter, you've had this scene where this family man very skillfully, violently kills two people, and he doesn't know how. And so we're rooting for this guy because we are, like I say, he's a family man, and I make him purposefully relatable. He's not some sort of your typical bodybuilding Superman operator. He's just a typical man. And so the hook is you getting your audience to be behind the character, and then a mystery. Like, why, like, how did this happen? And he legitimately, I mean, you're in his head. You're not holding anything back from the reader. And so the reader knows, gosh, this guy really doesn't know. And so that's the hook.
Yeah, I think the mystery is the element of your writing that I found to be the strongest as I read the book. It's that delicate balance between giving the reader too much and not enough. Not enough, we're confused and uninterested, and too much, we can predict it too well, and you've just managed that so well throughout this book. I remember constantly just wondering what was going to happen and if the information Red was getting from other people was even accurate. I really enjoyed that mystery element.
No, I appreciate that. I mean, my goal was to try to get the reader inside the head of Red, the main character, and let them walk through it as he would. Because you'll notice I don't have a point of view, and this isn't necessarily the way that the genre normally goes, but I don't have a point of view from the antagonist. And so, because in this particular case, I didn't feel like it was necessary, but also I didn't want to let the reader see too far ahead, because I wanted them to really relate with my main character and to see things and have things unfold as he would experience them. And so that was my goal.
Wow, I think you did a great job with it. Yeah.
Oh, thank you.
I didn't even realize there wasn't an antagonist point of view until you pointed it out just now, but I was like, oh yeah, it's just Red and Wood.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, we've got a couple others in there, and it's interesting. Because that, I've written my second book, and I'm 99% of the way through the third book. They're all in a series, and I still don't have the point of view from the antagonist. There are a few small or short scenes where you might be in the head of someone that may be going after him, but they're very, very brief. Again, because my goal is I want the mystery to be revealed as it would be revealed through the eyes of the main character.
Okay, so before we dive into any specific scenes too much, let's just talk about craft in general. If you could go back to your amateur self when you first started writing, what would you do different, or what is something you wish you knew back then?
Right from the start, I would have told myself, hey, listen, right after the first chapter, go find yourself a work group. That's what I would have told myself. I would have, I would have saved myself a ton of time. Rewriting something is so much more difficult than just writing it correctly from the get-go. And, I mean, my second book, Oma, was, don't get me wrong, I had a blast writing my first one, but rewriting it was so painful and learning. But writing the second one was an absolute joy. Yeah, it had its issues that needed to be ironed out, and there's always a certain amount of rewriting to be done. But it was nothing like the first book. So I would tell myself, number one, I would say get into it's basically an accountability group is what it is. And get into a writing work group where people are going to give you honest feedback and not fluff it up. I would say never discount what the feedback is, such as, oh, I really meant this or what I meant that. And you know what? Again, the reader just, you know, David, the reader doesn't care. You know, the reader only has what you put on the page. And so, as it's been told to me before, the readers, we as authors need to keep in mind, the reader's always in trouble. The reader's always in trouble. So we have to lead them and guide them and see the story, not only from the perspective of your character, but from the perspective of the reader. I would tell myself early on, master, point of view, understand it, use it, so that you can actually use it to create a more immersive experience for your reader. I believe I have taken large steps toward mastering that piece of craft, the point of view, but there's still a ton for me for me to learn. I feel like every time I learn something, it's just, it's like keeping, you know, to use a cliche, it's like the cliche of the spinning plates. It's like every time I figure out how to spin one more plate, someone else shows me, oh my goodness, there are five more here that you need to start focusing on now. And so, you know, I've got, as you're writing, you've got 5, 10, you know, maybe 15 plates spinning. And then you just realize, oh my goodness, we're just getting started. And to kind of go back to what you're talking about with editing, it's like an editor may look at one plate and say, hey, you know, that one needs to be spinning faster, but they can't appreciate, like, you are, as the author, are the only one, in my opinion, you're the only one that can see all the plates start to finish, and you're the only one that realizes what you do to one will affect how you can react to another one. So I would tell myself, you know, understand as much of the craft as you can. And that's not difficult because as writers, I mean, there are a lot of really good craft books out there and they're not that long, but just, things that talk about, oh, how to teach or how to get across to the reader personality traits of your character. And their feelings and emotions, how do you get that across to them without saying, without saying they felt this? I want to roll my eyes because I can't tell you how many times, I got dinged on that. Pardon me. I got dinged on that whenever I turned in my first manuscript. They said, listen, you need to take out anytime you say he felt or he thought, just take that out and simply state it. Show it. Don't tell us that because it's distancing. And so there are those little nuances of the craft that I would tell myself, you need to figure this out so that you can save yourself 2 years of rewriting.
I feel you, man. I remember my first experience with a writing group. They tore my manuscript to pieces, and leaving the group, it was clear that I had no idea what I was doing, and if it was something I wanted to pursue, then I needed to learn.
Exactly mine as well. I completely agree. And it's like they tore my, you know, I brought in my first chapter. They, just like you said, they tore it to pieces. I fixed it. I came back. They tore it to pieces again. They fixed it again. You know, I fixed it again, brought it back. It's like after about four times, I realized, you know, I just got to keep going, and I'll learn this as I go. So, you know, finally I got the guts enough to just bring up chapter two. And by the time chapter six rolled around, my goodness, they're like, listen, you got so much fluff in here. There's one day, I mean, one time we literally crunched four chapters down to one. I mean, it was incredible how much fluff I had in there. But it's all part of the craft. It's all part of the craft.
Okay, so in reading books, what is one of the mistakes new authors make that just drives you crazy?
Well, I've mentioned a few of them, and I'm reading the book now, and it constantly, actually, you know what, becoming an author is kind of a pain in the neck, because becoming an author, it's difficult to actually have that immersive experience that you had before, because I'm constantly critiquing what I'm reading. And, because you just get into that mindset. And so as a book that I'm reading now, I can't tell you how many times their dialogue tags, for example, that role that kills me. You don't have to have he said, she said. People say, oh, it's invisible. You don't notice it. Well, yeah, you do. Because every single time you have he said or she said, you're unconsciously reminding the reader, you're not this person. You're actually reading a book. And so even if it's unconsciously, you're distancing the reader. So dialogue tags are one thing. You don't come in unless you have to. You should make it obvious through other means who's talking. And the reader can figure it out. Another one I mentioned already is just showing versus telling. Reader's smart. The reader's inquisitive. We have to keep that in mind. And just as a reader, if you go to a museum and you're looking at a piece of art, what I get out of that particular piece of art may be a little bit different than what you get out of that piece of art, but we don't have the artist saying, this is what I want you to get out of this. We each appreciate it for different reasons. In the same exact way, when you actually just show versus tell the reader, show the character, for example, show how he feels. Don't say he felt angry. I don't know what angry necessarily feels like, but if you say that his chest heated, if you say that that the hair on the back of his, it isn't a cliche, but you know, hair on the back of his neck stood up. Whatever, however that character actually feels when they're angry, then you can actually the reader is not only more immersed into that particular character, but they actually feel it as that particular character feels it, and they interpret it, depending on the reader, in different ways. It's really kind of interesting how that works. But the reader is inquisitive, and the reader is, they're intelligent. We don't have to spoon feed them. We have to give them enough. Again, it's that balance. The reader's always in trouble. We need to lead them and guide them and provide them enough to anchor them into the scene. But we don't need to insult their intelligence. Well, see, that's the thing, and an author has to be able to understand their own emotion. Like an author, it was told to me a while back, once you become an author, you never look at the world the same. And it's in many ways true. For example, my wife enjoys painting. So we're going for a walk one time, and she's looking at trees, and she says, you have absolutely no clue how many different shades of green there are in that tree right now. And because she was frustrated, she was trying to actually paint this scene, and it was really hard to replicate that. And only an artist would actually be able to look at that and see, wow, there are 20 different shades of green in that particular tree. Well, as an author, the same thing. We need to be able to be connected in a way that a lot of people may take for granted. So when we experience life, when we feel anger, when we feel frustration, we need to be able to say, yeah, what does that actually feel like? And what emotions do we actually want to be able to make clear on the page? And not only that, but then we got to be able to figure out how someone else feels it. How your main character feels it, because how your main character feels anger is going to be different than the way that, his wife feels anger or his kids feel anger. It was a challenge given to me. One of the teachers in my group said, listen, do this. Write, describe the inside of a barn from the perspective of a farmer who just lost his son. And then contrast that with maybe writing it from the perspective of a farmer who's bringing in the fall harvest. And just the description and how you describe the scene can actually help display what your emotion, what you're feeling. And so that's another piece of craft that you can use.
Those are great points. And my favorite is where you point out that, you know, when you're experiencing these emotions, when you're feeling anger, as an author, it's a great time to really examine that emotion. How does it feel in your skin? How do your organs and your muscles and everything feel? And I think that was the point of takeaway for me right there. I mean, it just gives you a good reason to get angry, I guess.
Yeah.
In your own writing, do you have any rituals that you do that really help you get into the flow state and get a lot done?
I do. Before I get in, I mean, I've gotten to the point where I used to be able to write in a fairly busy environment. And I don't know why, but as I progress, it needs to be more and more sterile in the sense of, you know, less, you know, no interruptions, no phone, no window. If there's a window, I need it shut just so I can immerse myself as much as possible. And maybe that's because of now I'm aware of the different plates that I need to keep spinning. And it just takes a lot of concentration. So as far as the ritual goes, I try to have the least amount of distractions as I can. And then before I start writing, I try to get myself into character. Like as an actor, like getting into character is important. And so spending time getting into the head of whoever's point of view I happen to be at the time. Like, am I a mother of three? And, if so, what am I feeling now? What's going on? What's my background so that I know that, and each one of these characters need to have some sort of, you need to know where they've been and what their passions are and what their dislikes are so that, when you get into their head, when you start laying out the scene, you're firmly in their perspective, you're firmly in their point of view so that you can then more accurately replicate that on the page. So as far as kind of like what I do to get ready is I just spend a few minutes reminding myself who the character is, getting into their head so that I can then more accurately write what they do.
Okay, so let's dive into the book itself a little bit here. So usually I'll pull out quotes that I really like and want to discuss as they illustrate craft, but with your work, I found it was more scenes that I really enjoyed. The first scene that I really liked, and this was the moment when I was really hooked in this story, is when Red meets with the psychologist to discuss killing these people in the parking lot and the fact that he doesn't remember doing it. And then the psychiatrist or psychologist pulls out the video and shows him what happened and how quick and efficient it is. And as she begins to talk to him about, clearly you were trained. And his response is he just doesn't remember doing that. He doesn't remember any training. And that's when I was really hooked. So let's talk about that.
Understand what I was doing with that particular chapter was I kind of had to think through it almost in a sense logically, like what's going to happen next? I mean, this happened. So my group actually said, listen, the obvious next thing, because actually I didn't have that chapter in there originally. And so my group actually said, you know, he's got to go get checked out. He's going to be curious. His wife's going to be curious. And so you got to get him checked out. You know that at least the kids are going to have to probably go see a psychologist or psychiatrist after what they saw in the parking lot. And so then I started walking through, yeah, okay, so what I could accomplish, how I could further the plot. And can actually increase the suspense a little bit. And what I did was, I went and I talked to a psychiatrist and I said, listen, this is what my character did. So what would you do? And he was very open. He was a lovely retired gentleman. And he said, well, and he gave me what he probably would have thought. I mean, he said, could be any number of things, but I mean, he said you would definitely look for the obvious stuff like brain trauma or tumors or something like that. And so I put together this scene because I thought it was, that the book would be inaccurate or incomplete without it. But what ended up happening was really raising the stakes and really increasing the suspense. So it's the first time that he finally says, gosh, maybe there is something that I don't remember. I've been trained. They kind of come to that conclusion at the end of it. And then he says, well, where in the world did that happen? And so that's kind of at the end of that scene, my whole goal also was to increase the hook. I mean, yes, it is kind of the second chapter, but every single chapter you want to kind of get those folks hooked a little bit more, because there are many books that I've read where I've left off at the third chapter. Like I'll read the first one, I'm like, hey, this is possible. Then the second chapter, third chapter, I'm like, you know what? I'm just not going to finish it. So you really have to continue to increase that hook and build the suspense and deepen your characters so that the reader is truthfully invested.
So what was the next step before your group told you you should see a shrink? Like, what was scene two?
Oh my goodness, that was so many iterations ago. I didn't even have when I first started, I didn't even have a point of view from Lori until finally my instructor said, listen, next time you come in here, I want you to have a chapter written from Lori's perspective. And then I was hooked. Cause that's when, do you remember the scene on, in the aircraft where she's in a cough, and I don't want to give too much away here, but, and then that became one of my favorite scenes. But what happened, I went directly from that, but somehow, probably, I think I skipped directly to the scene that you were talking about where he gets, where Lori gets taken, where he gets at his home and the investigation. Yeah, I'm trying. I mean, you got to understand, this was, I mean, if I was to lay out all the manuscript revisions that I did on this, I mean, every single, I don't recall how many revisions of this manuscript that I did, but it was quite a few. And so, yes, we did take out quite a bit, but there were some that were added in. And this scene with the psychiatrist was one. The scene with the perspective from point of view from Lori was another one. And she kind of, we kind of keep it in her point of view. There were some scenes that I just kept, but yet I switched the point of view. So the fact that we stay within Lori's point of view throughout the story off and on is also planned. Like, in other words, that may have originally been written from someone else's perspective. It just depends. But I think what I did was I jumped fairly closely, fairly quickly into the scene where Lori's taken. And you have to have times in a thriller where you have a break or a pause. Like, it can't be all action proper, go, go, go. You have to be able to have times for, like, such as in the scene, the psychiatrist scene, where the reader has a chance to pause. So you can have an action scene, and then it's good to be able to have a pause scene where they can kind of catch their breath, because if not, it can really be exhausting and actually kind of distancing. Because in action scenes, you can't necessarily have a lot of depth built into your character. Why? Because things are going on. It's in the pauses that you can actually build the character. And so that actually helped me in those, inserting a few of those other scenes into the book earlier on, helped deepen both the connection to Red and his wife, Lori.
Okay, so let's talk about the final scene I wanted to cover here, and that is the investigation at the house. This was my favorite scene in the whole book, and I felt like the mystery was just so powerful. As each detail was unraveled, I just got more curious about what was happening and what was going on. So talk to me about building that mystery. Like, what did you intentionally leave out, or maybe what was pulled out during revisions or added to create that scene?
Well, again, what I tried to do was reveal the scene as Red would have experienced it. And so we had to come up with something like, Red's not a passive guy. I mean, he can be aggressive when he needs to be, as shown in chapter one, but I wanted to be able to, he had to be either away or out in one way or another for something to be able, for someone to be able to come in and threaten the family and actually take Lori. So I figured out what would it be like, you know, waking up out of a drugged state, let's say. And so I started there, and then just the confusion that he might be in when he finds himself, gosh, he's in the hallway versus in his bed. He didn't just fall out of bed. What's he doing in the hallway? And as he kind of tries to get his wits about him, almost as if you're coming out of, like I say, of a drug state, he then realizes, oh my goodness, yeah, my head's bleeding, it's gashed open. What about the kids? And so I just sort of walk through, like, a lot of times, and this is more of the, maybe more of the artist perspective, but a lot of times if you just put your character on the page and let him go, or her go, it makes a lot of sense what they do. And you just kind of have to ask yourself, what is the next logical thing that's going to happen? Or if you need a twist, okay, what's illogical and completely off the wall that we could throw in here to really kind of help deepen the plot? But in this particular case, you know, we knew Lori had to be taken. How would it be done? And then from that starting point, just revealing the scene through Red's eyes, because you could have it from, like I said before, like maybe the protagonist's eyes, the antagonist's eyes, maybe the wet team coming in after him. But that's not how Red would experience. Red would experience it waking up, being scared for his family, and then, oh my goodness, what happens when his family's not there, and all of a sudden the police are there, and then his friend Colonel Mayard shows up again, and then that's really when in that particular scene, by the time you end that scene, the rest of the book is really set up and flows nicely, because a lot it actually comes to head there, and that's really what precipitates the rest of the book, the op, the rescue, and then also the revealing of who he truly is.
All right. Well, that's everything I had. Can you give us some information on where the listeners can find you?
Oh, absolutely. DavidMcCaleb.com. And there you can find links to all the social profiles, Facebook and Twitter. I'm on there quite a bit. But DavidMcCaleb.com, and it's got all the links for the books, the Recall, which the one that we're talking about now is already out and available. Reload is coming out at the end of August. It's in copy editing right now. And then the third book, which I'm just now finishing up, comes out a year after that.
All right. That was our interview with David McCaleb. As always, thanks for listening. If you enjoy the podcast, check out one of Travis's books or leave us a review on wherever you listen. And as always, our email is please start writing at gmail.com. We are in the middle of transitioning our website. It's going to be a subdivision of my own website. That's joebandoski.com. And there you can read all the blog. There's book reviews. The review of David's book will be up there as well. And thanks for listening. To follow, David has sent me the first three chapters of his audiobook. So that'll just go ahead and follow right after this if you want to check that out.
Recall. A Red Ops thriller, as read by the author, myself, David McCaleb. Recall and all three books in the Red Op series were recently licensed by Tantor Media for audio production. So in the future, you'll be able to purchase the entire series as audiobooks. Chapter 1, 3 Seconds. Tony Red Harmon yawned as he rubbed burning, fatigued eyes with a palm. His cuff slipped back from his watch. 9:47 p.m. Too late for the family to be out. Nick dragged his feet on concrete, cheeks puffy, hand gripping Red's index finger, so tired he didn't even ask for a treat as they walked out of Walmart, past the candy machines. He looked up, snot glistening under a pink nose. Red winked at him, surprised yet again how his son looked like he'd cloned his mother's eyes. The shopping cart was full of things they needed but didn't want. School supplies and vegetables. A wheel with a flat spot clacked a steady cadence as Red pushed it under a rush of warm air blowing from above into the January chill outside. How do you always end up with the broken ones? He pushed with one hand, straining his wrist to keep the thing straight, pulling Nick with the other. He stepped slowly, carefully not to slip on the frozen pavement. Just ahead, little Penny held Jackson's hand so tight his fingers were turning blue. Her head was high. She was obviously pleased. Dad thought she was mature enough to guide her younger brother through the perils of the parking lot. Hope his fingers don't go numb, Red thought. Look for reverse lights. They're the ones that'll run you over, Lori told him. She reached for Penny, then tucked her hand back into her peacoat, as if trying not to be too controlling. Narrow hips swayed as she kept pace with the kids. Red looked back down at Nick, who was yawning again. Tired, buddy? I want to go bed. He laughed. Me too. Been looking forward to it all day. Lori glanced back, smiling, and lifted her chin. They passed through a fog of exhaust from an old Ford pickup, the decal of a deer and crosshairs on the back window. The smell of gasoline stung his nose. The SUV was parked far out, under the same pole as always, the lamp casting a cone of brilliance like a stage spotlight. A few snowflakes whisked through its beam like mayflies in summer. They passed a red Nissan Armada, just like one their petite Filipina neighbor drove, the vehicle's tires tall as her shoulder. The Armada was running, but without lights. Penny waited, watching the bumper, then scurried behind it with Jackson in tow. No more parked cars, so she skipped the rest of the way to their new Ford Explorer. Somehow it already had a dent in the quarter panel and enough fruit juice in the carpet to make your soul sticky as a lint roller. Penny had just pulled Jackson around the far side when Red heard two thumps, door shutting. He glanced back. It was the Armada. Three people were following them through the dark, hands in pockets, heads down. Red passed through a warm pocket of air arising from the pavement. He put Nick's hand into Lori's and reached for the keys. The horn beeped, the door lock snapped up, and the interior lights glowed. Kids, get in. He pushed the cart to the rear bumper, leaving it sticking into the traffic lane. The kids jumped into the back and slammed the door, smiling, glad their once-a-week shopping torment was over. Red grabbed Lori's shoulder, opened the passenger door, and pushed her in. The three men stepped past the shopping cart. Red locked the doors and tossed the controller into Dory's lap, relieved as the door slammed shut. All three wore black jeans low on the hips. Two were tall and sported matching red sweatshirts, hoods pulled up. A tight-fitting blue one covered the third, a short, slender man. He came close while the others stood back. While he lifted his head, the pole light illuminated a Roman nose and light brown skin. The hood shadowed the rest. He pulled a long knife with a serrated blade from his pocket. Its sharpened edge glinted in the brightness. His voice was young and scratchy. Your wallet, bitch. Sure, take the damn thing. Red glanced to the SUV. The kids were bouncing in the back seat, blowing into cupped hands, unaware. Lori had pulled out her phone and was dialing. She could drive them out if she had to. Red reached to his back pocket and pulled out the wallet, staring at the gangbanger's eyes. They were empty, soulless. Like his nephew strung out on meth when his sister had called for help last year. Red held the wallet next to his hip for a second, then took a step back. He slipped it into his pocket. What the hell was he doing? His life wasn't worth risking over a couple maxed out credit cards. His vision blurred, then focused on the glinting edge of the blade. It was as if he was watching his own body from above, his arms spread, hands still as steel. Words surged from his chest, from someone caged inside him, forcing their way through his voice box. Come and get it, bitch. Break. Tony, Lori said it again. Only now did Red realize she'd been screaming it. Her eyes were wide, pleading. She pointed to the ground. One of the gangbangers lay on his belly, blood running from his legs and a small pool forming under his head. Red was bent over, knuckles clenched in the man's hair, pulling him off the pavement. His forearm was bloody and he pressed a snub-nosed revolver at the mugger's brainstem. Where'd the pistol come from? The thug's eyes were closed. He wasn't moving. Dead? Resisting the urge to let go, Red laid the guy's head on the asphalt. Tony, you don't have to kill that one. Her voice was shrill. He backed up, pointing the pistol at the still body. Red licked a metallic taste from chapped lips, breathing fast and shallow as a panting dog. What the hell was going on? A tall man an aisle over held up leather-gloved hands, backing away. He ducked into a Dodge Charger, tires squealing as he accelerated out of the parking lot. Red slowed his breathing, then turned to Lori. The kids? Where was the Explorer? He spotted it a few spaces away. The shopping cart lay to one side, three pieces of number two pencils scattered across the pavement like pickup sticks. He jumped over the mess, landing next to two bloody heaps, the bodies of the other muggers. He squinted as the light reflected off one of the scarlet pools and stifled a retch. The SUV's rear window was broken. High-pitched crying blasted from inside. He ripped open the back door and saw all three kids in the seat, huddled. You guys okay? No answer, just more crying. He grabbed Nett's shoulder. The frail body was quivering. You hurt, buddy? Penny looked up. Is it over? A smear of blood was across her daughter's cheek, tear tracks streaking through it. He cradled her head, trying to wipe her face with his thumbs, only making a bigger mess with the blood from his hands. I'm okay, she said, wiping her nose with a knuckle. The blood, it's not ours. Break. The debrief room was gray, cold, and Spartan. Detective Matt Carter had designed it to look more like a morgue than a police interrogation chamber. 3 seconds, Carter said. Hard to believe. He sat in front of the stainless steel table he'd bought when the seafood plant across the street went out of business. The shiny, sterile slab and knife slots of the tabletop fit the mortuary theme perfectly. He felt in the pocket of his Davenza herringbone jacket for the pack of Wrigley's gum. That's all it took. 3 seconds. He unwrapped a stick, then checked the time of his titanium tag heuer. No clocks in this debrief room. It hadn't been a long night yet, he thought. Two delinquents dead. One all but. They deserved it, murderous punks, feeding their habit. If all three were gone, there'd be less paperwork. The Commonwealth attorney perched, buzzard-like, next to him at the table. Pencil-neck politician, probably resented being woken up this hour. Wasn't long ago that Carter had left Chicago's mean 7th District to become a detective in the sheriff's department of his sleepy hometown in New Kent County, Virginia. He still did homicide investigation, but at nothing like the one-a-day burn rate his team had done for years. The whole bloody confusion was still too familiar. The killer sat across the table. His reflection in the stainless steel was distorted, fuzzy from a surface scarred by years of fillet knives. Carter threw the green pack of gum on the table, then stood and paced, neck back, eyes closed. So what's wrong here? Stupid question. The killer, Mr. Harmon. Guy has a good job, nice family, no record, acted in self-defense. Video from the parking lot cameras proved it. Even Pencil Neck said they couldn't charge him. But Harmon's story didn't make sense. Experience told Carter when a piece didn't fit, something was hidden. But he had to be careful not to overstep legal bounds. Mr. Harmon? Yes, sir, he said, scratching his neatly trimmed beard. Eyes were bloodshot, starting to sag underneath. He'd been to the bathroom to wash blood from his hands, but still picked at what was dried under his fingernails. The sweater would never come clean. Mind answering a few more questions? Sure. Can I talk to Lori first? Absolutely. No problem. Carter peered through the small bulletproof glass window in the gray steel door at an empty hallway. Looks like Sheriff Jensen is still talking with her. Mind if I go through this now? Never answers my damn question. Knows exactly what he's doing. Poker-faced. Don't see why not. Maybe it'll jog your memory. Carter slipped out and grabbed the DVD off his desk. Walmart security manager wasn't there tonight, but the store supervisor gave it over when Carter promised he'd bring it back the next day. Yeah, right. Your vehicle was parked near a light. Surveillance camera had a perfect view. Carter slipped the disc into a player at the end of the table and fast-forwarded to 9:49, then pressed pause. If you honestly don't remember this, well, it's graphic. As graphic as a black-and-white security video can be. Harmon shrugged. If I did it, I need to see. Pencilneck pulled his chair closer to the TV. Okay by me, in a nasal voice, as if speaking through a pipe. Carter put it on slow motion. The closest gangbanger lunged at Harmon with a knife. He deflected the attack, grabbed the man's wrist and locked his elbow, then snapped that arm and pushed the guy's head through the rear window of the Explorer. He slammed a fist onto the back of his neck, slicing it open on the sharp edge of the broken window seal. As the body dropped to the pavement, one of the other thugs pulled a pistol from the front pocket of his sweatshirt. Harmon pushed it away, the gun firing three times into the air. He punched the attacker's neck, grabbed the pistol as the body fell limp, and took aim at the last one, sprinting away. That one knocked over the shopping cart in his haste. He was at full speed when Harmon shot twice with his left hand. The gangster fell, only his feet remaining inside the view of the security camera. Pause. Harmon stared at the screen. 3 seconds, Carter said. You killed two people, almost three, without a weapon of your own. And you don't remember? Sure you're not a black belt or something? Harmon rubbed a knuckle. Building manager, like I said. Time to press. Carter sat and pointed at the screen, rewinding a few seconds. Look at this. The guy who pulled the pistol, you punched him in the neck. Look at your hand just before that. You're not making a fist. It's flat, like a blade. I saw this guy's body. You didn't hit him. You stuck your hand into his neck, grabbed his throat, and yanked it out. That's why you've got all that crud under your nails. That's only second number two. A building manager, buddy, you're not. The last guy, the smartest of the bunch, runs, just not fast enough. 2 shots. You plant one bullet in each thigh of a moving target. 3 seconds. Carter stood, tipping his chair so it crashed to the floor. Harmon was lying, but what could he charge him with? Pencilneck shook his head as if anticipating the question. Carter had nothing. Hell, he should thank Harmon for cleaning up. You can't see the rest of the video, but you scrubbed his face on the asphalt. According to our only witness, the guy in the charger, you were swearing like a sailor. That's saying a lot coming from a house framer. He thought you were the assailant. Thank goodness no one else was packing or they'd have shot the wrong guy. No reply. Carter picked up the 3-page witness statement from the table and pushed it toward Harmon. I don't get this. He said you kept yelling, "Who are you? Who hired you?" as you beat the perp's head against the blacktop. Why were you asking him that? Red stared at the video screen and blinked. I still don't remember any of this. I'm sorry. Wish I could be more help. Yeah, sure you did. He knew Carter had nothing. That must have been when your wife got your attention. If she hadn't, you would have been guilty of manslaughter. The first two were self-defense, but this guy was running away. Good thing you didn't kill him. For your sake, that is. NHI. Harmon furrowed his brow. NHI, no human involved, Carter said. Harmon squinted and rubbed the bridge of his nose, as if to clear away disturbing thoughts. Can I see Lori now? Hell, this wasn't going anywhere. Might as well order cocktails. Yeah, that's enough for now. Let's get you home. Carter turned the doorknob. I'll see if the sheriff's done with her. The door behind him, making sure it didn't slam. What was missing? Harmon was evasive for certain, but displayed no signs of it. Carter, if anyone, could read signs. He knew people, personalities, and when the two didn't fit. Could tell when he was looking at the wrong pieces, or when some were missing. Oftentimes, like tonight, he couldn't put it together right away. It all had to bounce around in his mind until the parts formed a meaningful whole. The other detectives in Chicago had called it woman's intuition, all the time jealous of his clearance rate. He walked down the hall, head down, thoughts bouncing, turned the corner and bumped into Sheriff Jensen's belly. Oof, said the portly man. What you find out? Jensen's long, skinny legs led up to an ample middle, capped by skinny arms and neck. If he didn't know where something was on his gun belt, he'd have to feel his way. Country boy, North Carolina type. Once Carter had settled in, this hillbilly first impression faded. The sheriff was slow-spoken, but highly intelligent. Nothing got past him without notice. "You mean other than don't get on his bad side?" "Nothing. Just like he said on the ride here. He doesn't remember anything after he pulled his wallet, till his wife started yelling. Can't figure out why I don't believe a word of it. You pull his record?" "Yep. Nothing in it. Didn't spec find nothing nohow. Hell, known his father for years. NAM vet, his daddy was. Tony played football with my boys. Get one hand on a pass and he'd bring her in. Not a single fumble, no matter how hard he got crunched. Back then he was small, but you had to add 30 pounds for meanness. Nasty as a boar hog on the field. One time some poor linebacker got between him and the end zone. Bastard woke up 4 minutes later, 5 yards back and 6 points down." Carter shifted his feet. "Sheriff, I've got to, sorry. Other than a speeding ticket, clean. Talk to his wife. Damn, she's a hot number, ain't she? Real upset. Still shaky, so I didn't ask too much. Said he works as a building manager at Varnix." "What does she do?" "Some exec at a think tank, whatever that means. Process improvement, she says. Sounds like bullshit to me." Carter leaned an arm on the gray-painted cement block wall. "No reason to keep him. Mind if I let Red go home?" "Who's Red?" "The killer, you know, Mr. Harmon. Said everyone but his wife calls him Red." "Huh. Wouldn't have thought he went by that. Once got in a fight with my youngest for calling him Carrot Top." "Get him. I'll let his wife know they can go." Carter slipped back into the debrief room. Harmon was still sitting, arms on the fillet table, eyes focused nowhere. "Okay, been a long night. Thanks for sticking it out. Stay in town till we contact you. Go home. Get some sleep. Try to put it behind you. Remember, we've got counselors on retainer who can help you guys talk through things, especially the kids." "Thanks. I'm sad they saw it, but glad no one got hurt. Well, you know what I mean. We'll keep an eye on the kids. They're at my parents now. Always sleep good there. At least tomorrow's Saturday. We can all sleep in." The chair screeched as pencil neck stood. "I'll let you know when the suit's been filed." Harmon stared at him, blank-faced. "We're not charging you," pencil neck added, scratching a blotchy red cheek. "But this is America, so you'll be sued by someone, probably the house framer, for emotional distress. I advise getting a lawyer." Carter rolled his eyes. "Mind signing the incident report?" He pushed the form toward Harmon. The killer signed quick as a doctor, pen clinking over the knife marks, and pushed the papers back. "You ambidextrous?" Carter asked. "Not that I know of. Think I do pretty much everything right-handed." Chapter 2. Psych Visit. The hard black vinyl chairs of the waiting room squeaked as Red fidgeted, loud in the otherwise silent space. His legs kept falling asleep. He stood and stretched tense calves. The blue polyester drapes with scalloped edges that covered the single window smelled of cigarette smoke, probably from a patient who couldn't stand the delay, Red mused. "I should have been a doctor," he muttered. "Make you wait past the appointment, ask nosy questions, ignore your answers, then demand payment before you leave." Lori smiled and kept turning pages in Cosmopolitan, looking comfortable in the short chair, though she was several inches taller than he. She always looked graceful, even on a Monday morning with no coffee. "The county's paying. Relax." She flipped another page and glanced up, raising eyebrows. "We've all known for years you're half crazy. Good excuse to get you some free help." Red's lip turned up in an edgy half-smile. Her cheerful cynicism put him at ease, disarming the issue. A button on her blouse had come undone, revealing the black lace bra he'd bought last Valentine's Day. That had been a night to remember. Following his gaze, she pursed her lips, looked down, and buttoned up. "You must have slept good last night." A cloud passed and the sun shone through the window, warming his face. 2 weeks and he still hadn't remembered anything new. They talked about the Walmart incident often. Detective Carter called daily. Not a bad guy, outside the interrogation room. They'd almost become friends, despite the rough start. Carter seemed to believe his lack of recall. Last week, Red had been resigned to everything blowing over, but not Lori. He'd made the appointment with the shrink at her urging. Voices approached from behind the reception desk. "Next week," said a female in a jumpy Eastern European accent he couldn't place. A brown-haired woman tugged a young boy sucking a red blow pop behind her. Her face hung tired, her hair half tangled. "Next week," she replied, trailing the kid in her wake like a tugboat. A short woman with a round face and fair skin stepped into the waiting room. Her eyes were lively, set close together behind thick-rimmed glasses. She was trim, maybe even prim, sporting a pressed black pantsuit, like a miniature pallbearer and the owner of the accent. "Good morning. You must be Mr. Harmon. I'm Dr. Christian Sato." Red shook her hand. Her fingers were too short to wrap around his, and cold. "Yes, ma'am." She closed her eyes and bobbed in a slight bow. "I see you brought your wife." Head inclined toward Lori. "Actually, she brought me." Her cheeks rounded even more as she smiled. "Please, follow me." So she was Japanese. He was never good with accents, not like Lori. But how'd she get a first name like Christian? Chinese, maybe. Or, Dr. Sato looked back and stopped. "I'm sorry, Mrs. Harmon. Please wait here for us. Today we'll be with your husband alone." Red frowned and gripped Lori's elbow. "Doctor, I'd prefer her with me." She saw the whole Sato's cheeks tighten. All the unassuming humbleness drained away. Eyebrows rose to pointed triangles, as if the doctor were possessed by an evil twin. Red didn't know whether to laugh or turn and run. "As did you," she said, looking past him to the empty waiting room. Her smile returned. The demon must have decided to move on to another host. Another bob, and she continued down the hall. Lori rolled her eyes, then smacked Red on the ass. "Go on, then." She went back to her chair. Sato opened a black walnut veneered door, its deep purple iridescence caught by sunlight beaming through a window. She almost needed to reach up to grasp the handle. Red stopped on the threshold. His shoulders drooped when she pointed to a short black chair like the one he'd just escaped. She pulled out a high-backed wooden stool from behind a 60s vintage metal desk, drab green, picked up a pen, and flipped open a pad. "So, tell me why you're here." "I'm doing very well, thank you." Sato's pen tapped the paper. Red squirmed, glanced at the door, making sure it wasn't locked. She reminded him of Aunt Susan's rat terrier, the one that used to snarl and bite at his calves when they visited every Christmas. He'd kicked the mud away, but it just kept coming back, growling and nipping like a rabid chipmunk. She smiled again. "Tell me about yourself." Maybe if he'd play along with short answers, he'd get out faster. No such luck. Sato kept firing questions back about family, his parents, then his brothers. Did they fight? What the hell kind of question was that? "Of course we fought. If either son of a bitch were here now, you'd probably see a fight." More questions, as if she liked to hear him talk. After half an hour, she took off her glasses and rubbed two red dots on the bridge of her nose. "You'd make a lousy dance partner, Mr. Harmon. I can't help if you don't cooperate." "See how all this is going to do anything." Denial. The narrow armrest dug into his elbows as he pushed himself upright. "What?" She set the glasses back on her nose, peering over the rims. "That's what we call it, denial. You've recently killed two men, almost three. Out of character, wouldn't you say? Yet you're not concerned with figuring it out? Why?" Red clenched his jaw. He detected a faint whiff of cigarette smoke again. "Yeah, I want to do that. But what if you write down on that pad I'm crazy? Maybe a danger to my family?" Her tone was gentler now. "I'm here to help, Mr. Harmon, not disrupt your life. I realize you may be worried." "You think?" he exclaimed. "If I'm to help, we must trust each other. The only way that'll happen is if you open up." She slipped off her stool with a hop. Didn't stand much taller than when she was sitting. She walked around the desk with folded arms, hands clasping elbows, heels clicking the floor, pen slapping in and out. Her shoes had 3-inch spike heels. Red smiled, though he tried not to. "If I give you a clear picture of where I'm going with the questions, would that help you open up?" He tilted his head. Sure. She walked behind him. "At first, when you called, I thought maybe brain tumor or head trauma. Your file says medically discharged from the Air Force, almost crushed to death when a bank of shelves fell down on you. So, could be, I thought. Then I received the Walmart video from Detective Carter." Red sat up. She'd already studied his case. "What about the video?" "Let's do some deduction about the way you killed those men. I would say you've been trained. His nails dug into the armrest. I told you I've never been trained for anything like that. Maybe it was some sort of adrenaline overload, a reaction to, no, she stuck out her lip. Adrenaline can't teach you how to do a task you don't know. What you did was skillful, violent. She stood next to his chair now, leaning forward, flaring her fingers before his face. Even beautiful. He snorted. You're nuts. You ought to be the one in this chair. Sato's cackle startled him. She strutted back to her stool. Ah, yes, three ex-husbands would agree. Maybe she wasn't such a bitch after all. Least she could take a joke. Red got up and went to the window, stretching his legs to get the blood flowing again. Felt like needles in his skin. Back to deduction, she said. I see a lot of military in my practice. In a situation like yours at Walmart, a civilian does what he's told. But if you've been trained, well, that's where it comes out. She thrust her palms toward him. So you didn't do what you were told. Maybe I panicked. The video doesn't support that theory. Only other option is trained. He scratched the cow licks on the crown of his skull. Whatever. Sato leaned over the desk, fingers flat on the top, the tips white. So, we've accepted that you were trained. Now, don't you want to know why you can't remember that? Are there other things you aren't remembering? That's why the questions. That's why you need to open up. The chair squealed like nails on slate as Red slid himself back into it. He pushed his legs straight out in front and clasped his fingers behind his neck. Okay, I'll quit being a jerk. How do you feel now about the killing? His eyes studied the ceiling. Don't know. Try not to think about it, I guess. But now you can. When I do, it seems surreal, like watching a movie. I really don't think it's hit me yet. I see, Sato scribbled a note. Sleeping okay? Like a baby. What about dreams? Any strange ones? Nightmares? None I remember, but... Yes? He closed his eyes, trying to think back. Okay, had one. In it, I was tied to a chair with piano wire. The punk, the one I didn't kill, he was beating on me. Hurt like a bitch. I was in a hospital, bandaged up, just like after all those shelves came down on me in the warehouse. Then I woke up. That's all. She underlined something. Feelings of guilt for doing what you did? He yawned. Why should he feel badly? No, they were trying to kill me. She hopped up. Let's dance, Mr. Harmon. I want you to act something out. She grasped his wrist, gripped firm now, and pulled him to his feet. She pushed his chair toward the door, then sat on her desk with a jump. You saw the video. Pretend it's happening again. Tell me what you feel. Ready? Okay. One of the guys lunges at you with a knife. This lady was nuts. But why not go along? He slipped his hands from his pockets, wedding ring snagging on the seam. He closed his eyes and swung an arm. Yeah, the video showed... We know what the video shows. Quit thinking about it. Put yourself back there. 2 weeks ago. Just pretend. What do you feel? His eyes burned as he shut them tight. Okay, if he was crazy, he needed to know. This shrink might testify if the lawsuit filed by the dead guy's families ever went to court. What can it hurt? He envisioned the gangster holding the knife again, sharp edge gleaming. The last thing he remembered before the forgotten time. I feel relieved. Explain. Her voice was calm, almost seductive. Keeping his eyes closed, he pointed to the side, where Lori would have been sitting in the truck. Lori has the keys. The doors are locked. She's already dialing 911. Even if they kill me, my family's safe, so I'm relieved. He tilted his head. Another thought appeared in his mind, as if a spotlight had just shone upon it. But those other two, if they've got a gun, they could still hurt them. How does that make you feel? His heart beat heavy, but slower, the cadence you'd use to work a sledgehammer on a wedge to split an unyielding piece of firewood. I'm angry. Not scared? He huffed, surprised. Oh, no. So the first guy lunges at me and I... The sledgehammer swung faster now, harder. A presence, a ghost, distantly familiar, was knocking to be let in at his mind's door. He licked salty perspiration from his lip. Now I'm scared. Sato's voice was deadpan. Now as at Walmart, or now as in this room? He strained to pull his thoughts back to the present, to this office. What had that been? Maybe he was crazy. He opened his eyes. Nothing. Just scared then, at the idea of being robbed, I guess. She dropped her head, as if disappointed, then hopped off the desk and climbed back onto her stool. Mr. Harmon, you're a terrible liar. I realize you're scared, so we'll take it as slow as you want. Before you go, here's something to think about. You say you have memory problems, yet clearly you knew what you were doing when you killed those men, handling yourself with adept violence. She pointed her fingers to the ceiling. You pulled out a man's throat. I never even knew that could be done barehanded. The fact that only two are dead is not by chance. 3 seconds later, you're interrogating a prisoner. She leaned forward, staring with two close eyes. You don't remember training. You don't remember a fight in the parking lot. The two may be connected. It may not be the first time this has happened. You see? Let's find out together, shall we? She slapped the pad with a pen and leaned back. Or you could possibly have past brain trauma. I'm going to ask your doctor to order an MRI. Either way, next visit, I do want your wife in here with you. She smiled again, the devil back in her eyes. By their wives, ye shall know them.